Tom.
Hi, folks. Can I just check that you can hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, we're, bye. We're halfway there. So it's lovely to not be here. I'd prefer to be there, but it's nice to half be there or whatever this counts as. This will never feel normal, you know. But I'm waving from Edinburgh here. I'm sitting in the wee office at the back of the house in Edinburgh just now. I joined your event a little earlier and was discombobulated would be the word that I would use initially. And I thought, well, this is a classy open mic, but by God, the word discombobulated has gone viral in Ireland recently. So, and then I slowly cottoned on to the fact that this is part of your writing challenge. So I'm just getting myself up to speed with what's happening. I should confess that the writing challenge is usually that part of the dream where I wake up screaming myself, so which is why I didn't join you even earlier. Otherwise, I would have put myself through it too. But bravo, that was really wonderful and enjoyable. I think the plan is that I read for about half an hour and I'll leave a wee bit of time for some questions at the end. I hope that is sort of roughly accords with your own expectations.
That's
and normally if I could see you, I would you know, I would decide on the hoof what to read, but because I can't really make out the whites of your eyes, I'll just have to kind of guess as to what you might like. I'm suffering from a sober disadvantage here as well, I should say, so that may affect my choice of material, but because I'm very far away, I might also take the opportunity to inflict some brand new stuff. And as much as all I have to do is unplug the computer and I'm out of here, so it's just. So I might inflict that on you for the first time, if that's okay. But I'll start with a couple of poems from the most recent collection, which is this. Can you see that? Maybe it's backwards. I don't know. It's called The Arctic, Some poems at the start were written in memory of my dad, who died about 4 years ago of dementia, as increasingly so many of our parents do these days, as we seem to maybe live a wee bit too long sometimes. But and my dad was a musician, and some of those poems are concerned with the fact that a cliche about dementia, which turns out to be perfectly true, which is music's the last thing to go, you know, the tunes were the last things you could remember. And in fact, he had a whole mnemonic system worked out. If you could name a year and he could tell you what guitar he was playing that year. So I would just say 1967, and he would scream Epiphone, you know. And he had this, even though he couldn't remember our names, he was able to recall, you know, sort of, you know, some an awful lot of songs towards the end. His last coherent sentence was actually, Alexa, play Lyle Love It. True story. not quite his last words, but last sentence. So my dad played country music in Scotland. He played country and traditional Scottish music. But he was a brilliant accompanist, and there was no kind of last round Sinatra, you know, however bad, that he couldn't seem to make sound really, really good, and often much better than they deserved to. He just seemed to know where their voice was going to go somehow, and he was able to follow it with his guitar. And this, I'll start with this thing. It's a fairly lightish poem, given the subject, which is addressed to the worst singer I ever heard my dad accompany, in Kirkintilloch. Social club. The song was Una Paloma Blanca, for the record, so it's not mentioned. anyway, on sounding good. Sir, know this, that you were utter shite in the Kintilloch social club that night, when at the beginning of your next of kin, you rushed the stage and counted yourself in. Resolved to give it loudly, your best shot, all you had, and more that you did not. and a number you'd pinpointed in advance with a misplaced yet granitic confidence, and a Maunder Green of two words which belong to the chorus of a wholly different song. And yet my father, on your 1, 2, 3, took one breath to exhume your opening key, then shadowed you as with Apollo's harp to your ascent from E-flat to K-sharp. But you barely heard the man with the guitar who guided you towards the final bar and off into the safety of the wing, like the Dalai Lama gently shepherding a drunken wasp towards an open window. Nor, as you reached your bestial crescendo, did you see just how his providence had lent the guise of logic to each chance event, a velvet tray of right made for the wrong that was the alien spanners of your song. He did all this because he had an ear like the sea that raised him, open, true, and clear. So on that night, as every night, he chose to make you sound good, or good at least to those who loved you. And since he had love to spare, your knowing this was neither here nor there. Sorry, that, you misinterpreted that. I wasn't like, I will now pause heavily until you clap me or I'll not read any more points. That was me looking for the next point there. So it's don't feel obliged to clap this one, obviously. You know, sorry about that misunderstanding. Well, I don't understand that convention of not clapping, you know. It's quite funny, isn't it, these odd conventions that spring up. I mean, feel free, you know, to... You know, if you hear a metaphor that strikes you as particularly impressive and you want to clap halfway through the poem, I'm not going to stop you. So it's your applause is welcome. Thank you. I'll read this. I'll try and read this one. It's a poem called "The Snabba," which is a nickname that my dad had for me when I was a wee boy, and I didn't understand for many decades later, and indeed after he died at the I kind of rumbled what the word meant. Anyway, snabba. I hadn't heard the word in 40 years until then, at the ragged hem of sleep, just once in his bedside voice. That word only he would call me by, and only when I was sick or cried out from a dream. Why would he console me with it now? I put 3 whole years on that rainy month. His death seemed almost lost in all the trouble. Why so out of time? Although the dead don't know to keep the order of our days. But perhaps one doesn't ever really mourn those obliged to leave us by degrees. Our last tears are relief, if there are any. The blessing of a death to take him clean was denied that man of purely good intention, who left us through a puncture in his side, a slow leak hissing all that made him him, I will say so, back to the receiving dark from which it first had calved, then found its host. It was a stronger vessel than he needed. The sickness was a stair into a cellar where not one thing had edge enough to name, but the steps were shallow and he took them slow, so mostly I was dead to it, and dry-eyed, bar perhaps the last time he restrung his good guitar, and everything was backwards and upside down, and him weeping in anger. Oh, Dad. But otherwise, eventually he slept. If we discount that last astonishment I'd only seen before on the just born. Snabba. From before I could remember, a name so often mine I barely knew it, although all names are strange, so long unused. Back then, all I heard was the love in it, the way his father too had called him by the same Mayan's pet word, maybe from the Norse, meaning child or beloved one. The last time I was 16 and shivering and raving in the last bed in the ward when I thought they were all trying to kill me. Snabba, he'd said. Of course, now that it's all I have of him, it's so obvious I could laugh. Snabba, Sobol, that was all he was calling me, his own childhood Scots. And now the boy with the white hair and the white beard holds his knees and makes himself very small and round, because now he is very cold and he has no father. Oh, God, love. Thanks. Thanks for that. I'll read a poem called The Winter Apple. It's fairly, it does what it says in the tin. It's about an apple, and it's winter in it. A winter apple. Here, I got you one of those you like, those bewildered late bloomers, tough and small and sweeter than they've any right to be. As green as Eden, the red an afterthought, as if there'd been an hour left in the season to paint them all, and where the brush had swept the snow-white fruit below is stained with pink, as if your teeth had bled from biting it. It was hard enough to body itself forth with so few leaves to hide it from the frost, without it burning fuel on working out where its skin stopped and its flesh began. All that touched it shook its heart. It was that or it was nothing. Take it in your pocket for your long Sunday walk to eat by the loch with that lone jackdaw only you can talk to. I make no great claims for this little thing, but I promise only good will come of it. I'm feeling bold enough, far enough away enough to say a couple of new things. I'll read this stupid squib just to start off with, which was one of those commissions that you forgot you had. And I was reminded by the dedicatee a few nights before it was due, and it was for the BBC, and it was about the 100th, it was about the centenary of the founding of the BBC, and you were supposed to write something on that subject, and understandably, I think I'd forgotten about it. And I was reminded by my friend Denise Riley, who likes this kind of thing, I think, and I wrote a wonderful poem about the football pools for her commission. But so I ended up writing something about I used to write really bad radio drama, and I was always I was astonished to discover that people didn't really kiss in the radio. They just made wee kissy noises in the back of their hand. Which is it's a funny thing the first time you witness it. You seem like a game crowd from here. Can I request a bit of audience participation just for a laugh, see if this works? This might be a really stupid thing to do, but at one point I will pause heavily, okay? And at that point, I'd like you all, as one man and woman, to kiss the back of your hand as loudly as you can. Is that okay? Just make a noise. You know? I've never done this before, and I can't believe it's going to go well. But let's see how we go on. Kissing on the radio. For Denise Riley. Actors faced with beat, they kiss, lest kissing lead to awkwardness, cold sores, flu, or simply bed, will opt to kiss themselves instead. And thus the radio drama snog is how you tell just how a man precisely feels about his hand. For men, alas, will often hog this bit with, "Darling, would you mind?" or "Come here, you," or "I beseech." And in the well-timed plonker, find a way to silence her mid-speech. They broach the pop shield with the back of their left paw and plant a smack with lots of extra wet and suction to be dialed down in post-production. where was it? Now hearken to the glowing tank. What is that sound? The crunch of locks? A horse with an apple, that final yank before the toilet sink unblocks? Oh dear, real kisses we efface. We lock our mouths down tight like rubber seals on docking ports in space where nobody can hear you slobber. Now pucker up. Can you resist a cheeky morsel level test? Come on. Ha ha, loser. No, I'm joking. But wasn't that a touch heartbreaking in its sad, squeaky isolation? Imagine the compounded shame of doing something quite so lame before a whole attentive nation. Now play that little squelch again, and the old style tape delay your brain keeps around for such short measures as it would play back at its leisure. And as the quality degrades and your auto embras gently fades into the Atlantic churn, to which all smackers must return, ask yourself, what clever folly could honour say that secret Santa who blew your mind beneath the holly? A ring pulled on a can of Fanta? Would you brick a ripened peach for that white hour in late December you made out on the stony beach? The sound's the last thing you remember. So thesps, when scripts call for a kiss, just say your line and pause like this. And trust the thrill of the dead air. We all know what to slap in there. That got enthusiastically autoerotic at one point, though. That was no mere squelch. But maybe it was amplified on the Zoom, but that was kind of finally deafening. I'll read another couple of new things. It sounds like a rather esoteric premise, and it's maybe so. But the thing I'm working on just now is there was a series of riddles written by a guy who called himself Symphosius. I don't think that was his real name. A Latin poet, sort of only minor distinction. But they were kind of after dinner riddles. And they weren't very good, to be honest with you. And occasionally folk have translated them, and they're fine. They're a bit like, the Exeter book riddles. There's, of course, a great Celtic tradition in riddling, but they're a bit like sort of Exeter book stuff. But the cool thing about them is there's 100 of them, and the subjects are great. So what I'm trying to do is write a poem for each of the answers to these riddles. So this is the collection itself is called The Enigmata, but they're just daft wee poems written on the answers to the riddles themselves. They've got nothing to do with the poems, really. So I'll read a few of these, if that's all right. So these are some answers. First one's called Pen. Point to plane, point to line, behold the literal abstraction. Draw the quill from her left wing, I'm after some capillary action. Swan for broad and crow for fine, eagle no for loots. For mine, an e-pen on an e-ink pad, much like my father's slate on slate. The first script wasn't law or lore or poem or play or prayer, but a plain receipt for what was placed in common store. The second, hawk. The reckoning is what we do. We keep the word, the books, the warrant ironclad. Hence the guild's first rule. All men will have a voice, but not a pen. This one's about a tile. At least that's the answer. It's tile, as in roof tile. Tile. Once brought to earth, she'd hit a tree in fog. Dragons don't rot down like gulls or whales, but lie there, their own perfect effigies. Said one born to that rainy place, what scales of polished jet? So he took his spade and stole enough to make his little house invincible. Strike them right and they just pop out whole. Alas, the pink patch soon turned dark and wormy, so they stripped her bare and rolled her in a trench. But then the smell came, terrible as a dead army. The wells went bad and the harvest to the dogs. Later, Captain Woods, miles from the stench, a crone recalled the time they'd plucked a phoenix for its eternal self-igniting wicks and then burnt the town to the ground. And by degrees, this led to the birth of the general principle. That's enough of that. There will be a lot of these one day, I hope. I'll read a poem from the book Before the Arctic, which is has an equally bonkers premise. And the poems in Zonal are all derived from the first season of The Twilight Zone. I don't know if you know the old American TV series, The Twilight Zone, which was a kind of amazing, surreal thing that happened, you know, sort of as the Cold War was properly getting underway. So it's an incredible, surreal, paranoid exercise. And the poems themselves are sort of autobiographical in some ways, but they're all based on one episode of the first season. That's a bit as much as you need to know. So I've and the first, I'll read the first poem in the book, which was really an opportunity to write a poem called Death, which I've always wanted to do, and now I have achieved that. So Death, and it's about a guy who regularly encounters death. And death's a rough gig. Death. His trick, by which I mean the way he'd convinced you of his earnestness, was to actualize at some random and unpredictable post, unruffled, immaculate, like he'd been there all along, vaping at the turn of the stairs, taking a leak in the adjacent stall, or turning round from a seat in front of the empty matinee, saying, "Come on, been through this." And again, I'd get up and leave, and I'd mutter, "I'm not ready yet." And he'd say, "Okay, bud, I'll see you tonight," knowing we all got worn down by this in the end. Before they kicked me upstairs, I used to work in sales. I still have a case of three samples and an eye for an easy mark. One day, he was working through some genre cliches to keep himself amused, and I was closing the bathroom cabinet when I saw him at my shoulder. I shrieked, he cracked up laughing, I swung round, and we fell into the usual threadbare exchange. But I caught him running the back of his hand across my Pima cotton towels and sneak a sidelong look at my new Sonic toothbrush with more than just a casual interest. I noticed his Prada suit was a size too large and his floral tea cologne was Tommy Girl, though it smelled pretty good on him. It was then I saw it, his weakness. I said, "Look, look, I'll do you a deal." "No deals," he says. "You know that." "Hear me out," I say. "It's legit. Give me another 20 years and I'll kit you out. I'll be your go-to guy. I'm serious. Knock down rates." He said nothing, but the sweat was forming in his upper lip and brow. So I got out the case and did my old routine, told him I'm practically giving this stuff away, though it was tough to see him so easily played, so easily reduced, so worried and frantic, me pulling out one thing after another, him suddenly wondering if he could afford it all, patting his pockets, wondering if I took plastic, wondering if he had plastic, what plastic even was, his arms full of all the cool new things he wanted, a black fedora, a snakeskin belt, the silk tie with a Mondrian design. But then realizing he was technically neither salaried nor self-employed, a slave to his work, he'd always thought, but really just a slave, hand to mouth, hardly ever in the same town two nights in a row, sleeping on couches between gigs, everything he wore lifted from the closets of the dead, everything he ate, whatever the dead had left uneaten on the stove after he'd walked him to the car. All he wanted was a night off, a table at Cleo's so he could work through the card and then go home to his own shit. Some old jazz on vinyl, a valve amplifier, a good espresso machine and a workout bike, and maybe a wife and kids too in time. But whenever he thought of them, or rather what they'd talk about round the big TV or the kitchen table as he made his famous chili or the school gate after hockey practice, all he could ever think of was him delivering the bad news, as usual, the worst. "Daddy, what do you mean I must leave with you now?" Don't think for a second that Death loves his work. Even though I couldn't stop, we both knew there was no way he could pay for any of this stuff. I was holding back the tears for him. Who wants to see their own death fall to such a two-bit hustle? In the end, I gave up. I hugged him. I said, it's okay, I'll go with you. Just give me five to get some things and say goodbye to folks. And he was fine with that, and so innocently grateful when I really did come back, carrying a near-new pair of brogues, a couple of good shirts, and a nice blue jacket that I reckoned would fit him well. and I could see in his eyes that over the years he'd lost more than a few of us this way to this old play, and each of us had cost him like a life. So if I read a couple more poems, would that feel like about right? And you know, if you have any questions, I can, and they're easy, I can try and answer them.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect.
Great. Yeah. I'll read one more from Zonal, and I'll read the last poem from the Arctic. Let's go over the page. It reads quick. It's about Lazarus. I've always been fascinated with the behavior of Jesus over the business of Lazarus, aspects of which are quite un-Jesus-like. I do know what got into his head, I think. I would presume to guess. But anyway, so this is about Jesus and Lazarus. Lazarus. 3 days of death, one can survive by the usual subterfuges. There's enough wind trapped in the whale, the morgue is cold enough to keep the rot from setting in, or you took enough food for the journey. Although nearly everyone will die anyway, the most determined will at least have a fighting chance, should they somehow get the call. And as we know, a few do. Your work here is not yet done, a voice will say. Or, we're awfully sorry, but there's been a filing error. 4 days, though, when you're finished. We know this instinctively. The acids or the worms or the bacteria will have started to eat you, and you begin to rot, and you lie back in the dark and accept your fate. Hence, Jesus tarrying for 2 days before he headed to Bethany, despite the desperation of the call from Martha and Mary that their brother was on the point of death. When Jesus finally rolled into town, Lazarus had already been 4 days in the tomb, and by anyone's estimation, well past saving. So when Jesus famously and tersely wept, it was not just because of the sister's pain, but the suffering he knew he'd have to inflict on Lazarus in contriving the spectacle. If he'd had Lazarus on his feet after a day or two, it would have been regarded as no more as your common garden miracle. But after four, that's something. And foreseeing the chain of events, Jesus knew that if things were going to stay on schedule, the miracle had to be sufficiently triumphant. No Lazarus of the 4 days, no Palm Sunday, no Palm Sunday, no plot to kill Jesus, no death, no resurrection. Note that even Jesus didn't risk an extra night in hell. This is a unique example of Jesus sacrificing the pain of another for his own self-advancement, and he knew that it was not forgivable. All this was indeed pretty rough on Lazarus. The hangover literally from hell apart, for weeks afterwards, he was still picking off the threads of muslin that stuck to him, with the seed that seemed to gather and cling everywhere, the gaps in his toes, under his nails, behind his ears. He was badged with bruises, and his skin was ghostly and creamy with a weird vernix of the restored flesh. When his wife wouldn't come near him, he assumed it was the taint of death. "What is it? The stench on me?" "No," she said. "The stench of the grave I can handle, and it's fading, and you've lost weight. And to be honest, you look younger than you have in years. And I've always had a thing about scars." "No, and I don't want to sound ungrateful. It's that I expected a whole new Lazarus. You're still a shitty git, still working the angles, still telling me what I think I want to hear. Husband, should getting back to your old self really be your goal here? You seem to be throwing away the opportunity." It was true. What kind of gift was rebirth into the same person? Besides, he'd actually been trying to change when he fell ill, to be less of a selfish prick and get fitter, walking rather than taking the donkey everywhere. He'd even improved his diet and cut out red meat, but he'd eaten some bad limpets and ended up with paralytic shellfish poisoning. Then Lazarus remembered what had happened on the fourth day underground. Having given up on any thoughts of return, he'd sunk into a boundless peace far beyond anything the word had once invoked. Lying there in the warm, enfolding darkness of hell, whose torments had been farcically overstated, he ceased to cling to life or hope for his return and had lost all sense of his own boundary. He felt himself become one of the dead, his pronouns shift from I to we, and freed into that radiant collective. And then he realized that was what he'd brought back, the gem he'd loosened from the deep matrix of the earth. A dead man walking was a grand thing to be if you'd already died. Alive, but done with the fear of death, free from the disapproval of others that used to torment him daily, since he had no Lazarus to be protective of. And so he allowed the black, glistening jewel to grow inside him. He was still who he was and could never deny or absolve himself of his old life. But he was also all that he was not, everyone and no one. And day by day, the timeless crypt grew inside him like a kind of vow. And because death is good and kind, by degrees he became a decent and honest man. I'll read one poem, and that'll be me. And this is a poem called August. From a part of my life about 20 years or so ago now. Did someone give the tree the magic words? One week of sun, then suddenly great bunches of ochre and orange drupes hung from the branches, so sweet already, half were holed by birds, or stuck with wasps too loaded to shoo off. But half of them were perfect and pristine, polished eggs of sunstone and citrine, and half was 40 times more than enough. What we couldn't eat, we stoned and froze, or did until the freezer wouldn't close, or left out in the wall for passing folk to sticky their hands with on their evening walk. The plum trees' buds had all come at once. But obviously this is a circumstance suboptimal for plum trees as for men, and it never really fruited right again. By winter, you and I were good as done. I crept round like a target of the state, killing lights and listening for the gate, while you cut down the birches for the sun and rued it in an instant, guessing right that when the kids got back from school, they'd cry to see the windows full of empty sky, and we had to draw the blinds till it was night. But that one summer held us in its blaze, the spirals turning slow as galaxies in the boys' gold crowns, while high above their heads, the girls leapt in the boughs like plum tree dryads, and the half-mad tree sowed fruit along its spreading arms, drunk as a father at a wedding, refilling and refilling his own cup, not giving a damn if it could keep it up.
What? May I get the microphone? Okay, technical issues. Don, that was a wonderful reading. Like, it really felt like you came through to the room and like you're here with us, and it was really splendid. Big round of applause. So we have a little kind of Q&A session, and I've thought of some questions, and audience here more than welcome to ask some questions. So the first one, sorry, there's a little bit of noise in the room here. So the first one I was going to ask you, I was thinking about, is when would you know that a poem is finished? Like, you know, when you've been looking at it for a while, working on it, when would you know it's finished?
I think it depends on the poem. Some of them you just get sick of and you think that's enough, you know. The old truth is that there's no hurry for this stuff, you know. It's just like, so you might as well just wait until you get it right, you know. And I'm sure most of you know the story of how Elizabeth Bishop worked, you know, and she'd be like, she'd have a poem finished apart from one word that was missing in the middle of one line, you know, and she'd stick it on a cork board in front of her desk, and it would sit there for 5 or 10 years until she got the word right. I mean, you might as well get it right, you know. It's there aren't really any deadlines with this stuff. So But I suppose that's one of the reasons that, you know, one of the advantages of writing in form, at least with a bloody sonnet, you know, you're done with a thing when you've got up to 14 lines, or you completed the form. But I don't know, I find increasingly that what worked the last time doesn't work the next time, and that every poem is its own genesis and own kind of generative narrative, and you have to just pursue it. You know, so every poem got its own tale, and some of them have been the work of 10 years, you know, it's not a constant work, but with the occasional labor of 10 years, and others were completed in a kind of, you know, horrible night of just pulling a couple of overnighters and feeling like I was going to get the flu and die, you know, and everything in between. So I don't think there's any way, really, you know. There's that famous line about poems being abandoned, but I'm not sure that's true. I think that's a romantic fiction. I think you know when you're done.
That's a terrible answer.
Sorry, but
that's the thing. It kind of almost sounds like poems are their own like living entities, their own living creatures, would you say? Like after...
I follow Michael Longley in that. You know, he always used to talk about, you know, sort of it needed a kind of yin and yang. It needed a, you know, sort of a sperm and egg, you know, and it grows up in your house and you try to sort of look after it. I think you have to treat them as if they were. Otherwise, you end up imposing your own desires on them and insisting that they be that. And they often don't want to be that thing. They often want to be something else. So the worst thing you can do to a poem is keep dragging it back to your subject matter, you know? That's why one tries to avoid good subject matter. I don't think there's any such thing. My rule is if I get a good idea for a poem, it isn't. And I should just run away. If I know what I'm writing about, it's usually bad. You know, it's just like, whereas if I have a hunch or a niche or a line that I need to pursue and figure out where it's going, then it might be good, you know. But if I know what it's going to be, then everyone else will know as well, you know.
Thanks for that, Don. Did anyone in the room have any questions? Yeah, Antonio. So Antonio asked, what inspires your poems? Could we have some quiet, please, Constantine? Thank you. So what inspires your work, Antonio? Don, Antonio asked.
I don't use the word inspiration because it happens so infrequently, and if I did use it, I'd be really depressed, you know. So inspiration didn't play a huge role in my work. I suppose what passes for inspiration is the bit that you get for nothing, you know. So I occasionally get lucky and I'll get a phrase or I'll get a, you know, half an idea or again some two things that go together and I don't know how they go together, but I know that the poem will help me figure out how. And that's, you know. And I suppose there are the traditional sources of inspiration, you know, which lead poets to live the chaotic lives that they lead, you know, those reliable sources of inspiration that we have that tend to hurt everyone around us. You know, as your man said, you know, it's kind of... it's kind of like flying your kite in a thunderstorm, you know, and poets often elect to go out in thunderstorms, you know, and it doesn't do their constitution or indeed their families much good. But, getting really screwed up is a good way, being inspired, you know. Having your friend and family die. Elegy. Elegy is another great source of inspiration for poets, of course. You know, and you have to remember that, a friend is just a kind of inconvenience standing between a poet and a half decent elegy, you know. So I wouldn't be friends with him. I'm joking, it's hard to say. I think there are honestly more reliable if you're just looking for, you know, things to inspire you, then you just go out of your comfort zone, do a geographic, go somewhere different, go to the zoo. That's what Rilke used to do. It was easy enough. Just go to the zoo, you know. Not that we should be going to the zoo at all, of course. Zoos are terrible places, but, you know, watch David Attenborough. Something nice.
Lovely. Any other questions in the room? Oh, yeah.
I was just curious, like, when you published your first book, was it just surreal to see your words in print, or like, what was that process like to see it in your head?
Could you hear that, Don? Do you want me
no,
to repeat?
No, you couldn't.
Okay.
Yeah, I couldn't hear a word at first.
No, I'll repeat it. So someone in the room was asking, what did it feel like to see your first book in your hands? You know, was it surreal or, you know?
Honestly, it was, I think, maybe the worst case of post-Christmas letdown I've ever had in my life. Because I was so excited and I thought, you know, I'll get this book. You know, and it'll be that. I'll be me. I'll be like that. You know, I won't. You know, I'll have such faith in myself, and I'll, you know, and I'll be this most marvelous, holy, glowing object, and I can carry it everywhere, and you know, and be super confident. and it was like, oh, you know, it's like, oh God. The first thing that you do is traditional. It's a bit like a bird crapping on you. That you open it on a spelling mistake. That was the first thing that I did. You know, that you'd missed. I now know that that's good luck if you do that, so I don't feel so bad. But it's so that was the first thing that I did, and then I remember with the first book they'd accidentally screwed up the paper, so it was printed on something that looked like old fashioned World War II toilet paper, like Izal toilet papers. Not just see the poem in the back, but the poem through the other side as well. You know, it was just like, so there was that, but. But in all honesty, the bigger lesson was that I realized that the only time I was going to feel like a poet was when I was writing a poem. It wasn't the book that was going to make me feel like a poet, and it wasn't doing a reading to you good folk that makes me feel like a poet. The only time you feel like a poet is in the act of writing. And that's the reason that I'd say, if you like feeling like a poet, and we all do, is drag that bit out, you know, drag it out to hell. You know, make that bit as long as you possibly can. And the knowledge that it's the person who has the patience to sit for a few hours longer looking at that line who gets the goods, who gets the really good poem. It's so much of it is about patience more than talent, you know? And it's the one time you feel like a poet. And unfortunately, the book appears to confer that status on you, but, you know, I don't know. I'm sounding like a Calvinist here, am I? It's just like, it just increased my capacity for self-loathing, sir. But it's, it was a chastening experience. Yeah, I now try to cultivate neutrality on those occasions.
It sounds like it's like you get to the Wizard of Oz, and then you just see this little man behind a curtain.
Yeah, it's you. Yeah,
yeah.
No. Not you.
It was me all along. I'm back. We have another question, yeah?
Does she enjoy editing?
Okay. Do you enjoy editing your work?
Editing my work?
Yeah, do you enjoy editing your work is what the last question was.
I don't use the word editing of my own work. As partly having worked as an editor, I think editing is what you do to someone else's work, but your own work, you're just writing it. You don't edit your own work. I think partly because words like rewrite and edit are predicated on an idea of error, and you haven't committed any error. The poem just isn't finished yet. So you're not doing anything wrong, you know. So you're not fixing it. It's just finding its way towards its final form. So I would not use the word edit in the context of my own work. No, I think that's for someone else to come in with a kind of editorial perspective and another pair of eyes and to show you things that you can't possibly see because you're too emotionally opposed to the work, you know.
That's a lovely way to wrap it up, I think, because you're being delicate with your own work and, yeah, not editing, cold clinical. Don, thank you so much again for your reading. It was really wonderful. We're going to be moving on now to the for a break, or are we going straight? Yeah, we're going to have a little break, but a huge round of applause. Thank you so much again.
Good day to you. Sorry, can't be here.